Do you remember wearing flowers in your hair?
Did you buy a VW van to travel overland on the hippie trail to Afghanistan or India?
Did you stand shoulder to shoulder with your fellow protesters shouting, "Make love, not war"?
Here on Boomer Bedtime Stories, we take a deep dive into the adventures of a generation.
That will make you laugh, make you cry, or just shake your head.
Wondering, how on earth did we ever get away with that?
Welcome to Boomer Bedtime Stories. I'm your host, Karen Heaps. Today, our storyteller will take you back to the tumultuous time of the spring of 1970, to the time of the Vietnam War, to the time of the Kent State Massacre, where four students were killed by the National Guard in an anti-war rally, to a time when young men were being drafted and doing whatever they could to avoid that draft.
I'm David Brinkley, NBC News. Kent State University in Ohio has had campus violence for three nights, causing the National Guard to be called in. And today the guardsmen opened fire on the students, killing four of them, two young men and two young women. Three were shot in the chest and one in the head. A dozen or more others were wounded, some by gunfire and some by bayonets. The university is closed and all faculty and students have been sent home. The students were protesting the American invasion of Cambodia.
My guest, Jeff Shugart, was one of those young men, one of those draft dodgers. He is a gifted writer and a talented musician. There is a touch of the never grow up in Jeff.
You know, it's absurd, but, you know, 70 years old or whatever, and still wondering what we're going to do when we grow up.
His band, Sweet Papa Lowdown, is a lazy take-me-down-the-river kind of a sound. Traditional jazz blues and made up of world-class musicians. Jeff feels there's a mystical quality to his music.
I just assumed that in a previous incarnation I played in one of those bands, and I just keep revisiting it like a ghost.
My poor heart has never been the same, and every time I see you coming after me, I feel like peaches hanging off the tree.
His writing is published regularly in Geist magazine. His story, Twilight Dream Song, will take you on a journey of madness within and madness without, a story of sadness and disillusion, a story that taps into the fullness of our humanity and our yearning for human connection. It is touching and so close to the bone.
I didn't allow myself really to revisit that experience, you know, for 50 years or so.
Twilight Dream Song, Remembering John Berryman. It was shortly after the horror of Kent State that I had myself committed to a psychiatric clinic on a reckless ploy to beat the draft. The violent unhinging of the American dream profoundly messed with my equilibrium, and I turned radical, dropping out of the Minneapolis School of Art. There I took to the streets with thousands of others and was arrested twice, once at gunpoint and once tear-gassed and clobbered over the head during an anti-war protest march. Study seemed ludicrous in an apocalyptic world. In my long hair and my anarchist leather coat, I was smoking way too much weed and staying up all night with fellow art school reprobates talking revolution and drinking Thunderbird with the winos across the street in Washburn Park. This descent into counterculture militancy was the only authentic response to the madness I could envision for myself. The clean-cut, callow youth my parents had cheerfully waved goodbye to only 10 months before was now unrecognizable. A lost kid in a nut house pretending to be nuts. In the very real darkness of the soul I experienced in that psychiatric ward, in nights dripping with inconsolable loneliness, I wondered if my pretense was actually necessary. Lights out came early. There was little in the way of diversion. We were given our meds and we zoned out. I was placed in a room with a patriotic middle-aged trucker named Charlie. Immediately regarded one another with mutual contempt. Fuck this, I thought. I might as well be sharing a prison cell with my worst enemy, the flag-waving redneck trucker and the militant hippie locked up together in a room barely large enough for two small beds. There was no escaping the war, even in there. Its toxic seepage oozing into every nook and cranny of the national scene, poisoning everything in its way. Nothing less than a new paradigm was needed. But that was taken care of on November 22, 1963. Washington, now only 6 years later, resembled Hitler's Berlin bunker with the rat Tricky Dick scurrying about with his creeped-out feral minion, the BB Robozos, all leaving their own trails of slime behind them. At night, I'd sit on my bed facing away from Charlie and gently play my guitar before falling asleep. Then the inevitable horror would come. Every night without fail, Charlie would violently awaken, choking to death with some terrible affliction. Hanging from the headboard of his bed was a buzzer to summon's help. The nurses would rush in and revive him. Apparently, there was nothing medical science could do to alleviate his suffering. This gruesome life and death drama was unnerving. More than once, I wished Charlie would just give me a break and die already, as I never got a full night's sleep with him thrashing about. Lying in bed, wide awake, deprived of sleep and without solace, I could not have been more miserable. The days passed in a Thorazine haze. I stumbled about among the broken and doomed, doing my time, questioning my own sanity. Outside the hospital, my world was literally in flames. Kent State, I learned, had sent shockwaves across the country. Some 4 million students were on strike, shutting down over 400 universities and schools. 2 more students were killed and 11 more wounded by police during yet another demonstration. I felt that there was no place for me to light upon, to lay my head down in peace. One day, though, into this bleak confinement, a miracle appeared in the form of a girl named Laura, who was undergoing a series of brutal electroshock treatments. She and I were the only teenagers in the ward and were inevitably drawn to one another. Transfixed by her luminous aura and the extraordinary grace in which she endured her daily trauma of the shock treatment, I couldn't help but fall in love with her. Suddenly, there was light. We talked for hours from the profoundest depths of our heart, sharing our innermost thoughts. I planned our escape together, somewhere far from the madding crowd. I had friends living on a commune in British Columbia. I had a cousin in San Francisco who could put us up, help me find a job. She readily agreed to every fanciful scenario I proposed. Throwing her arms around me, she'd whisper, "Yes, yes," over and over in my ear, her tears wetting my cheek. What more could we possibly have done than to create a fantasy for ourselves? Everything was broken, heartbreaking, doomed. Her bedside became a magic playhouse we crawled into to be alone. Every minute was precious. She had a small white sheep made of wool that was her faithful companion, her comforter and protector. She slept with it beside her. Our love was platonic. There was no other choice. But one day, without warning, she kissed me. Then another day soon after, she kissed me again and told me that she now had 2 protectors, the little sheep and me. My heart leapt, but I could see in her eyes that her light was diminishing. I lay down beside her on the narrow hospital bed. For just a moment longer, we had a future. But I was not alone in my love of Laura. Another platonic suitor appeared one day. Much to my surprise, I entered her room to find the poet in my place at her bedside. I had seen him in the ward, of course, sitting alone, wrapped up in a trench coat like a shrouded corpse, the sorrowful eyes behind the thick framed eyeglasses, the full-blown biblical beard, the suffering palpable. There was no approaching him in such pitiful condition. He was a tormented soul, barely hanging on to life. His fellow patients all left him alone to his suffering. I had yet to read his work, nor did I know anything about his lifelong struggle with depression and alcoholism, or his father's suicide in his childhood. He seemed ancient to me, but he was at the time only 58 years old. His first words to me upon meeting were, "I've been waiting for you," offering me a playful smile. He had obviously gotten through the DTs, the worst of it, and was on the mend. I turned to Laura. She was smiling, too. "Sorry to keep you waiting," I replied. "What can I do for you?" I asked, playing along. "Oh, not much," the poet replied. "I was just hoping to see you on your way. You know, have a little visit, send you off into the world with a well-medicated fanfare." "Sure," I laughed. "Am I going anywhere interesting?" "Yes, I do believe you are. From what I hear, on a long journey, my young friend." "Really? That's great," I said. "When do I leave?" "Oh, you already have, son," he told me. And so it was that John Berryman, this profoundly wounded magus, entered my life for a brief moment. He joined Laura and I in our make-believe playhouse, and there was much laughter, care, and love shared between us. Whatever demons consumed him in this a final attempt to dry out a tenderness was evident. He rarely spoke of himself or his work, although I remember him describing his plight as the blood of the poet. Laura was our entire world. It seemed inconceivably cruel that such suffering and beauty could coexist in one being. I am haunted to this day by her courage and laughter, the feel of her slender hand in mine, her head swathed in bandages. We three formed a loving bond that transcended our wretched reality. Reality had no place there. One day the poet proclaimed that he was going to adopt her. Laura loved the idea. "Perfect," I agreed, as I too yearned with all my heart to save her, to be her protector, her lover, her everything. The days began to pile up. I took the meds, did what was asked of me, and jumped out of my skin every night to Charlie's panicked strangulation ordeal. But my fate there was uncertain. After several weeks of confinement, with no exit date forthcoming, I began to wonder if my risky plan to fuck the draft had backfired on me, and in some cruel irony, the medical staff had decided I actually did belong there. I felt that I was teetering on the edge of personal disaster, a soul in self-imposed purgatory. One day I had been an 18-year-old art student, smoking pot, hanging out with my counterculture friends, the next locked up in this bleak confinement, futilely yearning for something I could not quite grasp. The poet understood. He could see right through me. He and I would sit quietly on opposite sides of Laura's bed after her shock treatment sessions, holding her hands in ours, praying for her safe return to us while she lay there in a coma-like state. It was in these anxious moments that Berryman spoke to me of what he described as the journey within the journey. The journey he insisted I had already begun. We'd sit facing one another, and he'd regard me with those sorrowful eyes. Then in language, both familiar yet barely comprehensible, he laid out the roadmap for my inner life. I will attempt here to capture the essence of his words. "What you don't yet understand, but you will someday, my friend, is that this ugly war, your being here in this phosphorescent tomb with all this suffering, the lostness, the torturous sleepless nights with your truck driver nemesis, the acrid stench of burnt-out human wiring in your nostrils. All these terrible things you're experiencing are not your destination, and they do not define you. They exist ultimately only to provide you with the means to come ever closer to your true nature. That is your destination, he exclaimed. That is the home you are searching for. You think you're here to get this document to dodge the draft, he told me another day. Sorry, but that's not it. Well, I mean, you may do that, but that's just incidental. Look deeper. Do you think that our meeting, our sitting here holding this beautiful girl's hands, is without meaning? Once you understand that there are various levels of understanding for everything that happens, your destination will appear before you. These realizations will probably be subtle. Won't be some, praise the Lord, revival tent show, healing of the lame and the blind. But you'll begin to say to yourself, aha, so that's what's really going on here. Then the real fun will begin. And with that, he grinned and placed his hand over mine. Hey, look who's waking up, I can still hear him exclaim as Laura would begin to stir, opening her eyes and focus in on us. My dashing heroes, she'd smile weakly, how our poor hearts overflowed. Each visit with John brought another talk about the journey, the mystery inherent in our very consciousness. This family of concepts we call fate, serendipity, irony, and paradox, those essential tools of the poet's toolbox. No one had ever spoken to me of such marvelous things before. No one in my entire life had ever spoken as directly to my heart as he did then. Each evening, I would have to leave Laura's bedside and return to my cell, to Charlie and the war. Each return there became more difficult to endure. I wanted only to sit beside Laura to speak again with the poet, to feel alive. I didn't know how many more tortured nights I could take. Then one night, after lights out while lying in bed, Charlie spoke to me for the first time. I was shocked to hear his voice. He asked me why I wasn't playing my guitar. I didn't even know how to respond. I didn't know what he wanted of me. I think your playing is helping me sleep, he said. It's nice and soothing. Last night was the first time in 20 years I've slept all night. If you don't mind, maybe you can play a bit for me now. I hadn't even been conscious that we had both slept through the previous night, that my music had any effect on him whatsoever. I got out of bed, opened the guitar case, and played for him. Sitting there, gazing out the window to the world I had once belonged to, I played my heart out for Charlie, for Laura, and the poet, and myself. I played until I was too tired to continue. I turned around then and looked over at Charlie. Sure enough, I could hear him peacefully snoring away, sound asleep. I put the guitar away and closed my eyes. In the morning, getting ready for the day, Charlie approached me and extended his hand, smiled warmly, and said, "Thank you. Thank you so much." Once again, he had slept the whole night through. Even the nurses were impressed. I took Charlie's hand in mine and returned his smile. The war, for me at least, was finally over. It was not long after Charlie and I made peace that my confinement in the clinic came to an end. I woke up one morning to find Laura's little white sheep regarding me from my bedside table. Seeing it there, I was overcome with a sickening dread. I dressed quickly and raced to her room, carrying the sheep with me. The room was empty. I lay down on her bed and quietly wept, holding the little sheep to my heart. I had failed to protect her, and my entire being was bereft. At some point while I lay there, I felt a comforting hand on my shoulder, followed by a voice I recognized as belonging to one of the nurses. "She left it for you," she said, meaning the sheep, of course. I must have fallen asleep on Laura's bed. Then, sometime later, I awoke with a start as I suddenly realized I had to find a poet immediately to see if he knew, if he was all right. But he, too, I was informed, was gone, discharged that very morning. I hoped like hell that he had left before learning of Laura's demise. Just like that, I had no one to turn to. It was though I had dreamed them up in my need for comfort. I remained in the clinic only a short while longer. Charlie and I developed a warm friendship based on compassion, mutual respect. We hung out together, shared our stories, but it was time for me to depart. There was nothing left for me to learn there. I was handed a certificate stating I suffered from paranoid schizophrenic tendencies and sent on my way. Soon after, I packed a bag, said goodbye to my friends and family, and got on a flight to Paris, the little sheep accompanying me for many years to come. It has taken me 50 years to revisit this moment, to say thank you and goodbye to the poet, something I never had the chance to do. I had entered the clinic a lost, floundering kid and reemerged a seeker, a traveler. I wish with all my heart I could have told John how very much he gave me, how his gift is alive in me daily, but he took his own life shortly after he left the clinic, and I was already far off in a remote hilltop village in the south of France. Still, I like to imagine he could have seen me somehow up there and was pleased. Looking back, hazy as much of the experience has become, I did not see the three of us holding hands at Laura's bedside as pathetic, the lost and doomed attempting to save one another. In my heart, I hold on to this memory as poignant, loving, and yes, heroic for its struggle against the darkness. It was with those two at that bedside that I first sensed that I was somehow blessed by the gods of fate, and that unlike the poet and the tender, long-suffering Laura, my fate was not sealed. My life might still unfold before me. As America plunged into the darkness from which it has never recovered, I found myself following another path.
We'll soon be breaking all those dreams we dreamt together. You know they can still come.
Wow, when I heard Jeff's story, Twilight Dream Song, I was so touched. Imagine being only 18 years old and wondering if you were ever going to get out of that place. We here in Canada had so many draft dodgers come, and they brought with them such a richness of spirit. If you have a story, if you were a draft dodger or a wife or girlfriend who accompanied her fugitive man out of America, please reach out. Send us your story to stories@boomerbedtimestoryradio.com. Again, that's stories@boomerbedtimestoryradio.com. While Jeff and I were chatting after the story, he shared some reflections with me.
If anyone listening to this podcast understands why our generation, the baby boomers, became such passionate social activists, please share that knowledge. And perhaps more importantly, why subsequent generations to ours seems to have fallen into lethargy, choosing, by and large, not to participate in the democratic process of effectuating meaningful change. I ask these questions because my American boomer friends and I, people I've known and loved for 50 years, often discuss this question, wondering what happened to silence so many voices. Thus far, we haven't come up with any conclusive answers. Some have offered the idea that there is a sense of futility, that their voices have no impact on government. Others suggest that the sinister dumbing down campaign has been a grand success. Perhaps as in the rise of civil activism, this backsliding is also simply organic in nature. Whatever the reasons, my friends and I, much like yourselves, watch with dismay as resurgent neo-fascist movements take to national platforms with hateful agendas that we feel should be anachronisms of a distant, violent past. Where are the millions of voices now, we ask rhetorically? Because for us, the marches on Washington that drew hundreds of thousands of people together, all the marches everywhere, are still very visceral experiences. For us who were there all drawing strength from the same well of peace, our desire for a better world, the insistence that we are all created equal, little of that desire has died. There are multitudes of stories of our visit to this well. This one is mine.
Thanks to everyone who made this episode happen. Production by Karen Heaps and Bailey Bates. Editing by Bailey Bates. Music by Sweet Papa Lowdown. And Jeff Shugard's writing can be found in Geist Magazine.
Do you have to be a boomer to share a story on Boomer Bedtime Stories?
Absolutely not. You could just be boomerish.
Or you could be a child, grandchild, parent, cousin, lover, or a friend of a boomer. We'd love your perspective.
Or you could tell your favorite boomer story for someone who could no longer tell it themselves.
After all, everyone loves a good story. And believe me, we boomers had some groovy times.
Yeah, man, it was far out.
Just email us a synopsis in 400 words or less of the story you'd like to share and send it to stories@boomerbedtimestoryradio.com.
That's stories@boomerbedtimestoryradio.com.
Drop out.
Turn on.
Tune in to Boomer Bedtime Stories.
And subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.